Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, March 15th, 2024. I'm your reader, Grace Barter. Linn County Public Health is working on a project that will place 7 vending machines stocked with free naloxone, a medication that combats the effects of opioid overdose, at public locations in Linn County. The vending machines will contain naloxone, which can reverse an overdose and is harmless if given to someone who is not experiencing an overdose. The machines also will stock wound care kits, condom packs, hygiene kits, alcohol swabs, tampons, and sharps containers. The idea is not actually a new idea. If you look across the country and even internationally, other countries and other states have been using vending machines to help distribute naloxone to residents, said Heather Meador, Clinical Services Branch Manager for Linn County Public Health. The machines and the naloxone are being funded by $150,000 that was allocated to Linn County as part of nationwide settlements with opioid drug manufacturers. The other supplies in the machines are being funded through other resources. The Substance Misuse Steering Committee of Linn County, which is comprised of representatives from several government and nonprofit groups that work to minimize the effects of substance use in the county, will manage the upkeep of the machines. Meador said the goal is just to make naloxone and these supplies accessible and to remove barriers so that individuals can get what they need to stay healthy and stay alive. Iowa reported 475 fatal opioid overdoses in 2021, a 12% increase from the previous year, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. In Linn and Johnson counties, drug-related deaths have been rising consistently since 2018, mirroring national trends. Numbers dropped between 2017 and 2018, likely because in 2017 naloxone was made available over the counter in Iowa. But from 2018 to 2022, drug-related deaths increased from 19 to 36 in Linn County and from 13 to 48 in Johnson County, according to Linn and Johnson County's medical examiners. Last year, a number of Iowa school districts, including Cedar Rapids and Iowa City Schools, adopted policies and procedures to stock and administer naloxone at the schools. Previous year, the Iowa legislature passed a new law allowing school districts to receive prescriptions for naloxone and created a fund to cover the cost. The law also established a fund to ensure first responders have access to naloxone and other potentially life-saving medications to reverse opioid overdoses. The Public Health Department hasn't released information yet about when and where the machines will be available. Meador said the department has approval for most of the intended locations, but still is working on one last agreement. The Linn County Board of Supervisors, at a meeting earlier this month, approved putting one of the machines in the Linn County Community Services Building, 1240 26th Avenue Court Southwest in Cedar Rapids. Meador said some of the machines will be placed inside buildings and others will be accessible outside. When there is substance misuse, not everybody is going to be ready for treatment all at one time. It's a journey, and sometimes people are in treatment and they have a relapse. It ebbs and it flows, Meador said. We want to make sure that they know that we're there to walk beside you and to help you, and we want to keep you as healthy as possible. That's really our goal, is how we do keep you healthy, and how do we keep you alive. One person is dead and four others were injured after a two-vehicle crash Thursday south of Anamosa, according to the Iowa State Patrol. The crash happened just before 1 p.m. when a 1989 Oldsmobile Delta driving east on Shaw Road failed to yield to a 2015 Nissan Juke driving on Highway 151, a crash report said. The cars collided, killing one and injuring four, two of whom were juveniles. The two juveniles and one of the injured adults were taken to the Unity Point Finley Hospital in Dubuque. The other injured person was taken to Jones Regional Medical Center in Anamosa. The name of the deceased and the names of the injured have not yet been released by the State Patrol. Lou's Deli in Nubo pays back nearly $30,000 in back wages and damages. The U.S. Department of Labor has ordered a Cedar Rapids cafe to pay back tens of thousands of dollars in wages plus pay damages after finding that its management pooled tips improperly for years. The department's investigation concluded that Lou's Deli, 1010 3rd Street Southeast, had been improperly distributing tips among management for at least 2 years, from September 2021 to September 2023. The investigation was launched in September 2023 after a complaint from a former employee when workers there found documents indicating owner Lori Konechny was including herself in the tip pool. The allegations, substantiated by the investigation, ordered Lou's Deli to pay $29,456, including over $14,000 in back wages and $14,000 in damages to 19 employees. The cafe was also ordered to pay a penalty of $1,325 to the Department of Labor. All back wages, damages, and penalties have been paid, the department said. Last year, now former employee Kara Angeletti and her co-workers discovered a stack of pay stubs for Konechny on a supply closet shelf. On the pay stubs, Angeletti said, there were lines for tips Konechny received, even during pay periods when the owner was on vacation. It is illegal in the United States for employers, including managers and supervisors, to keep any portion of tips for any purpose, whether directly or through a tip pool. An employer may not require employees to give a portion of their tips to employers or management, even if they receive minimum wage. Employees at Lou's Deli, who had the understanding tips were split equitably based on hours worked, noticed large differences in tip distribution among their own paychecks. I think we were all pretty shocked, Angeletti told the Gazette. A couple of us worked the exact same hours each week, and tips on our paychecks were anywhere from $100 to $150 different. Angeletti earned $12 per hour in her time working there from March to October. Her last paycheck at the cafe had about $160 in credit card tips for a 45-hour pay period. She said some employees at the restaurant made as little as $9 an hour. The only thing Konechny told me when she hired me is that credit card tips are divided between employees based on hours worked, she said. At one point, another employee said something to her about not receiving tips, and from then on, they'd get $5 to $10 per paycheck. The Labor Department's Wage and Hour Division normally conducts investigations over a two-year period, though she alleges the improper tip collection had been going on longer. Dubuque Bank and Trust closed its banking center in downtown Cedar Rapids this month, adding to recent closures of banking operations in the center of the city. The banking center was at 320 3rd Street Southeast. Future plans for the office space are unknown at this time. Regional Marketing Officer Steve Ebner said in a statement, "The Cedar Rapids branch opened in February 2022 and closed March 7th. The difficult closure decision was made as part of our efforts to focus our resources on the locations and services that will enable us to better serve our customers," Ebner said. Ebner said there was a handful of employees impacted by the closure, and the company is working to find other jobs at the bank for some of them. The bank continues to operate banking centers in the Dubuque and Des Moines markets. In the Cedar Rapids area, Ebner said business and personal customers can continue to use the company's online and mobile banking services, remote deposit capture, telephone banking, and a customer care center. Customers also may visit one of the other Dubuque Bank and Trust banking centers listed at dubuquebank.com. Wells Fargo closed its branch at 150 First Avenue Northeast on March 6th. The Wells Fargo Advisor's office on the building's second floor remains open. A massive amount of fertilizer spills into a southwest Iowa river. An estimated 265,000 gallons of liquid nitrogen fertilizer leaked from a farmer's cooperative in Red Oak early this week, and most of it went into the East Nishnabotna River, according to Iowa Department of Natural Resources. An investigation into the extent of the environmental damage is pending, but the crop fertilizer killed fish and might have affected the river all the way to the Missouri border, which is about 40 miles downstream from the southwest Iowa town, said Wendy Whitrock, an Iowa DNR senior environmental specialist who investigated the incident. Whitrock said it is likely the largest fertilizer spill she has investigated. The spill was reported Monday morning by a new cooperative after one of its employees noticed the leak and stopped it. The cause of the spill is under investigation, but the fertilizer leaked from a valve in an area where it is transferred from a very large tank into smaller tanks for distribution. The large tank, which holds about 500,000 gallons, is in a containment area that can prevent wider spills, but the transfer area does not have the same protection, Whitrock said. It's unclear how long the valve was leaking. Upon discovery of the spill, management immediately initiated containment protocols as per our established safety procedures, new cooperative said in a statement Wednesday. We promptly notified the appropriate local authorities and regulatory agencies and have been working diligently in close cooperation with them ever since. A spokesman for the Fort Dodge-based cooperative declined to comment further. That amount of fertilizer is worth hundreds of thousands of dollars. The cooperative lies just east of the river on the north side of Red Oak. The fertilizer flowed into a drainage ditch and then into the river. Its effects on the river was exacerbated by low river flow, Whitrock said. Higher flows can help dilute the contamination. The East Nishnabotna is flowing at just about 7% of normal at Red Oak, according to the U.S. Geological Survey. The area upstream from it has severe drought, according to the U.S. Drought Monitor. The Iowa DNR's on-site investigation into the fish kill has resulted from the spill was expected to conclude by midweek, said John Lorenzen, a fisheries biologist for the department. He declined to reveal its early findings, but noted the large amount of fertilizer that went into the river. The Iowa DNR alerted towns downstream from Red Oak about the potential effect the spill might have on drinking water. Although none of the towns draw water directly from the river, several have relatively shallow wells near the river, according to state records. Missouri state officials also are investigating the impacts the spill might have on the Nishnabotna River, which goes for about 10 miles in that state before joining the Missouri River. Kansas City draws drinking water directly from the river, but the Missouri River is large and the city is more than 100 miles downstream. Iowa has 576 water body segments on its 2024 draft list of impaired waters, a net reduction of 21 from the 2022 count. Still, more than half of Iowa's assessed streams and rivers had impairments, and 63% of lake or reservoir segments were impaired in the new draft list released Thursday by the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. High levels of bacteria were to blame for 44% of river and stream impairments, and turbidity and algal growth were the largest causes of lake, reservoir, and wetland impairments. Other causes were fish kills, fish consumption advisories, and high acidity. Here are some of the changes in 2024. Coralville Lake, which already was listed as impaired for bacteria and turbidity, now also is listed as impaired for algal growth caused by agricultural pollution, the Iowa DNR reported. Bloody Run, a popular trout stream in northeast Iowa, also gained an impairment in 2024. The stream was listed as needing more investigation in 2022 after a fuel spill. The department now has added low biotic index, which reflects diminishing fish habitat. Lake McBride, near Solon, was removed from the impaired water list. The lake was delisted because samples taken in 2020, 21, and 22 showed lower levels of E. coli, and measurements for algal growth also improved between 2020 and 22, the Iowa DNR reported. McBride's delisting is somewhat surprising, given the beach there had 7 weeks of swim advisories last summer for high levels of E. coli bacteria, which indicates feces in the water. The integrated report cycle is done in arrears. You look at data 2 years prior. NOAA Poppelreiter, supervisor of the Iowa DNR's water monitoring staff, said about the list, "We're always going to see some fluctuations up and down that may not be reflected in the integrated report." The department's beach monitoring program, which takes weekly water samples throughout the summer, also is an important tool, he said. It gives people a much more current data, as opposed to the 2-year time lapse between the summer of 22 and summer of 24. The Federal Clean Water Act requires states to list water body segments not meeting state water standards for their designated uses, such as drinking water, recreation, or aquatic life. The Iowa DNR is charged with creating water quality improvement plans called the Total Maximum Daily Load, or TMDL, for all the impaired or Category 5 segments. In 2006, the Iowa DNR crafted a TMDL for a portion of the Cedar River extending from Bear Creek in Palo to McLeod Run in Cedar Rapids. This section is where the city of Cedar Rapids gets its raw drinking water through shallow wells beside the river. The goal was to reduce nitrate pollution. The Iowa DNR said in 2022 it planned to withdraw the Cedar River TMDL because some criteria in the plan were too stringent. A former agency supervisor told the Gazette in 2022 he thought withdrawing the TMDL went against federal law. While I was working at DNR, when I was being coaxed, cajoled, pressured, any and all of the above to rewrite that TMDL, I kept pointing out, "Hey, there's nothing wrong with the TMDL," said Alan Benigni, the former Watershed Improvement Section supervisor who retired in 2021. "There's nothing in the Clean Water Act, its enabling regulations, or any of the case law that would suggest that we have any legal right to rewrite the TMDL." As of late August, the Iowa DNR still hadn't made a decision about the plan, which still is listed among 128 TMDLs in Iowa. The department is seeking public comment on the draft impaired water list through April 15th at ircomment@dnr.iowa.gov. Congressional challengers are filing papers to run for office. Iowa congressional candidates filed nomination papers to run for office this week ahead of today's deadline for candidates to file to appear on the ballot. Candidates in Iowa's four congressional districts will be on the ballot this November, along with races in Iowa's State House and Senate and county contests. This year's primary election is June 4th, and the general election is November 5th. In the first congressional district, Democrat Christina Bohannon of Iowa City, a former state representative, is challenging incumbent U.S. Representative Marionette Miller Meeks, an Ottumwa Republican. Bohannon was in the Capitol on Thursday to submit her nomination petition. Bohannon, saying she wants to bring a bipartisan voice to Congress, is running in a district National Democrats see the potential to flip. The district includes heavily Democratic Johnson County and GOP strongholds such as Van Buren and Mahaska counties. She argued Miller Meeks does not look for bipartisan solutions and caters to the far-right extreme members of her party. We need to find solutions. We need to work together to really tackle the problems that Iowans are facing, Bohannon said, and we need to get away from this divide that we see and this extreme Washington, D.C. politics. Miller Meeks filed for re-election in February, saying 2024 would be a pivotal election surrounded by issues that face everyday Iowans. Miller Meeks' campaign did not immediately respond to a request for comment on the election challenge. Miller Meeks also is facing a challenger from the right in the upcoming primary from Davenport, Minister David Pouch. Pouch, a Republican, filed his nominating petitions Monday. Pouch announced this week he has received campaign endorsements from former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee and Mike Lindell, the CEO of MyPillow, who was among the loudest voices spreading false claims denying the results of the 2020 election. David Pouch will be a strong and uncompromised voice in Congress to help save America from the oppression that has destroyed our constitutional liberties, national security, economy, schools, law and order, small business, and families, Huckabee said in a statement released by Pouch's campaign. Pouch has said that he's running because he believes the country is becoming too secular and that Miller Meeks is not conservative or biblical enough in her decisions. He cites her support for the Respect for Marriage Act, a bipartisan measure that required the federal government to recognize marriages performed legally in states regardless of the sex or race of the couple, and clarifying that religious organizations are not required to perform same-sex marriages. David's commitment to saving America by trusting in God's power is unwavering, Lindell wrote. In the second district, Sarah Corkery, a Democrat and Cedar Falls businesswoman, filed her nominating papers this week to challenge U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson of Marion. Corkery cited votes by Hinson that she believes have hurt Iowans, including voting against the Inflation Reduction Act and the federal infrastructure law. My whole career, I have been an advocate for breast cancer research and disability rights. I have started a business with my husband, and I have raised a family with three kids here, Corkery said. Northeast Iowa is a special place, and our families deserve a representative who recognizes that, not a mouthpiece for the Republican Party and their corporate donors. When Hinson filed to appear on the ballot in February, she criticized the federal leadership of President Joe Biden and said border security would be among her top issues this cycle. When Corkery announced her candidacy last year, Hinson's campaign said she would be a rubber stamp for the radical Biden agenda. We can't wait to contrast Sarah's extreme liberal views with Ashley's record of delivering conservative results for Iowans, campaign manager Addie Lavis said at the time. U.S. Representative Zach Nunn in Iowa's 3rd Congressional District and U.S. Representative Randy Feenstra in Iowa's 4th District both filed their paperwork to seek re-election in February. Democrat Lannon Beckham, who is challenging Nunn, submitted his nomination petition Thursday morning. Melissa Vine, a Des Moines nonprofit director, has announced her intention to run in the Democratic primary for the seat, but she had not filed her nominating papers as of Thursday afternoon. Feenstra faces a Republican primary challenge from Kevin Virgil, an Army veteran and former intelligence worker. Democrat Ryan Melton filed to run in the heavily Republican 4th District on Monday. Representatives for Iowa labor unions and the state's construction industry urged lawmakers to hit the brakes on a proposal to lower the tax rates businesses pay to fund benefits for unemployed workers. House Republican lawmakers on Thursday advanced House Study Bill 735 in order to gather more information about its potential impact. Representative Dave Dio, a Republican from Nevada, who chaired the House subcommittee, said he advanced the bill in order to seek a detailed fiscal analysis of the bill's impact from the nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency. The bill cleared the subcommittee 2-1 with Democratic Representative Monica Kurth of Davenport opposed. DeYo said the bill would be considered by the House Ways and Means Committee next week. DeYo said lawmakers want the legislative services analysis so they can be assured that when unemployment rises during a recession, business taxes won't have to be raised to keep Iowa's unemployment trust fund solvent. Bills must pass out of committee before receiving a legislative services fiscal note to create a more manageable workload for the agency. We don't know yet that the math works, DeYo said, so if the math doesn't work, we're not going to do it as is. Governor Kim Reynolds proposed the tax cut in January as part of a larger package of tax reductions. Under her proposal, Iowa would cut the taxable wage base in half and reduce unemployment taxes by about 40%. Under the bill, Iowa employers would pay a maximum rate of 5.4% on wages up to $18,000 per employee, as opposed to the current 7% on wages up to $36,000 per employee. It would also reduce the number of tax tables from 8 to 4 and reduce tax table rankings from 21 to 9, effectively cutting overall tax categories. Reynolds' office estimates the cut would save Iowa employers more than $800 million over 5 years. We turned our unemployment system into a re-employment system, and it's having the intended effect, Reynolds said during her annual condition of the state address in January. Our unemployment rate remains low. We have the 6th highest labor force participation rate in the country, and Iowans are now spending an average less than 10 weeks on unemployment because so many Iowans are drawing a paycheck instead of a government check. Our unemployment trust fund is full, to the point where we can reduce the unemployment insurance payments that employers make by half. representatives for the Iowa Federation of Labor, AFL-CIO, and IBEW, Iowa State Conference, worried that Iowa's unemployment trust fund will face challenges in the long term if the economy takes a downturn and business tax rates don't keep the trust fund alive. Nick Lanning, a lobbyist representing the union that represents electrical workers, said with recent layoffs by John Deere and the closure of the Tyson plant in Perry, now is not the time to make drastic changes to the state's unemployment trust fund. I know the economy looks good from the outside right now, but we're seeing some issues, signs even in Iowa that we could have some issues, Lanning told lawmakers. Maybe pump the brakes a little bit and say, let's consider all the factors we have here before we do something that could have long-term effects. The Iowa State Building and Construction Trades is registered against the bill. John Murphy, a lobbyist representing the group, said state funding for infrastructure-related projects is going to be seeing some challenges going forward. And when that happens, we are able to invest less in those major maintenance things, which has an impact on construction jobs and things like that, Murphy said. So having a healthy trust fund is important as we kind of anticipate these things and then as we actually feel them going forward. Peter Hurd, a lobbyist representing the Iowa Federation of Labor, AFL-CIO, cited a cut to unemployment benefits that lawmakers passed and Reynolds signed into law in 2022. Benefits that employees had were taken away, Hurd said, and now we're seeing a tax cut for employers. Would just hate to turn things that are safety nets for employees and give it back to employers. Kurth, who voted not to advance the bill, echoed those concerns. J.D. Davis of the Iowa Association of Business and Industry told lawmakers the association backs the bill and the drive to get more information about its potential impact. Davis, though, also expressed concerns about the long-term solvency and stability of the unemployment trust fund. Reynolds tapped $700 million in federal pandemic relief funds to shore up the state's unemployment insurance trust fund and avert an increase in tax rates as pandemic-related layoffs provided a major hit to state unemployment funds. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, March 15th, 2024. I'm your reader, Grace Barter, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. David George Harney of Solon, 83, died peacefully at home on Wednesday, March 13th. Mass of Christian burial will be celebrated at 10:30 a.m. Monday, March 18th, at St. Mary Catholic Church in Solon. Visitation will be Sunday from 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. at the church, where a scripture service will be held at 3 p.m. Burial will be at St. Mary Cemetery in Solon. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the Holden Comprehensive Cancer Center, St. Mary Solon Cemetery Fund, or the Dave Harney Memorial Fund. Dave was born August 15, 1940, in Iowa City. He was a 1959 graduate of University High School in Iowa City. On August 6, 1963, Dave married the love of his life, Mary Ann Sovers. Dave was a longtime Solon Big Grove Township farmer. He was also employed at the Solon Post Office for 12 years, Thomas and Betts for 19 years, and Victor Medal for 7 years. Dave was a member of St. Mary Church, where he was an usher. He was part of the Solon Football Chain Crew for 31 years. Joanne Huston of Cedar Rapids, 77, died Wednesday, March 13th, in her home from an extended struggle with cancer. A memorial service will be held at a later date at the Kingdom Hall of Jehovah's Witnesses, 2204 26th Street Northwest, Cedar Rapids. Joanne was born December 15, 1946, in Duluth, Minnesota. She married William Robert Huston on May 22, 1965, in Cedar Rapids. Joanne was a homemaker. Bill and Joanne worked together in their cleaning service. This allowed them the opportunity to do a work they enjoyed, teaching others about the message of hope from the Bible. Joanne Murphy Riling of Clarence, 90, entered into eternity on Tuesday, March 12th, while under the care of St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. Visitation will be held on Sunday, March 17th, from 2 to 4 p.m., and funeral services will be held on Monday, March 18th, at 10 a.m., both at Fry Funeral Home in Tipton. Burial of her cremains will follow in the Red Oak Cemetery. Joanne was born on December 22, 1933, in Rockford, Iowa. She graduated from Lost Nation High School with the class of 1952 and had the honor of being the prom queen. On April 25, 1953, Joanne was united in marriage to the late Virtus George Riling in Toronto, Iowa. Joanne had several jobs over the years, but she will be best remembered as working in Horstman's grocery store in Bennett and the working with her husband for many years in the Tipton Locker. Joanne attended Cedar Street Baptist Church in Tipton, where she had shared the gift of voice on many occasions. She loved to sing and act. She will be remembered as one of the cast members in the play Shrek, when she was 88 years of age. Leona F. Nye, also known as Peggy, 90, of Cedar Rapids, passed away Wednesday, March 13th, at her home. Visitation will be 2 to 5 p.m. Sunday, March 17th, at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids. Funeral service will be 10:30 a.m. Monday, March 18th, at Holy Redeemer Church, Cedar Rapids. Burial will be in Linwood Cemetery of Cedar Rapids. Leona was born July 6, 1933, in Prairieburg, Iowa. She was united in marriage to Lawrence Nye on February 20, 1987, in Cedar Rapids. She was a member of the VFW Post 788 and Holy Redeemer Church. Leona worked for Lefebvre and Rockwell Collins. Leona enjoyed gardening and canning in her younger years. She loved to dance and cook, especially big dinners on Sunday for the whole family. Her last big thrill in this world was ziplining at the age of 90. Casey James Drew, 54, of Cedar Rapids, passed away suddenly on Monday, March 11th. A visitation will be held on Monday, March 18th, from 4 to 8 p.m. at the Cedar Memorial Chapel Stateroom. The funeral service will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Tuesday, March 19th, at the Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. In lieu of flowers, donations can be made to their son Cooper's Memorial Fund at Green State Credit Union. Casey was born on August 11, 1969. Casey was a devoted husband, father, and respected finance professional. He dedicated 26 years to the city of Cedar Rapids, culminating in his recent role as Vice President, Chief Financial Operations Officer at Kirkwood Community College. Casey married Andrea Cooper in 2021. Stephen Pelisic, 72, of Marshalltown, formerly of Cedar Rapids, died Wednesday, March 13th. No services will be held. Paul Alexander, who was stricken with polio as a boy and spent more than 70 years needing an iron lung chamber to help him breathe, but obtained a law degree and later gained a social media following as he recounted tales of his life, died March 11th. He was 78. The death was announced in a statement from his brother Philip. Alexander was recently hospitalized for treatment of COVID-19, his social media site said. He was later released. Alexander, a native of Dallas, contracted polio in 1952 when he was six. Within days, he was nearly fully paralyzed and close to death, unable to breathe. A doctor performed an emergency tracheotomy to suction congestion from the boy's lungs. He awoke with his body inside an iron lung, a device that used air pressure to help patients breathe after paralysis of their chest muscles. "I couldn't speak, I couldn't yell, I couldn't cry," Alexander told the podcast Pandemia in 2022. "I couldn't do anything." As polio cases rose in the 1940s and 50s, some hospital wards in the United States had rows of iron lungs. In 1955, a polio vaccine developed by virologist Jonas Salk was approved for general use after a year of extensive field tests that involved more than 1 million school children. Alexander eventually regained his ability to speak and developed techniques to breathe on his own and spent increasing periods outside the iron lung. He received a high school diploma at 21 with the help of a tutor who was by Alexander's side for years. He went on to earn a bachelor's degree from the University of Texas in 1978, then received a law degree in 1984, and worked as a lawyer for decades. He often spent much of the day outside the iron lung, but he was never fully free of the device. As his health deteriorated in recent years, Alexander needed increasing amounts of time inside the chamber. The title of his self-published memoir in 2020, 3 Minutes for a Dog, My Life in an Iron Lung, describes his first attempts to breathe on his own as a boy after returning from the hospital inside the iron lung. The book took him 8 years to finish, sometimes dictating passages or using a plastic stick to tap on a keyboard. He was among the last patients to use an iron lung and, at times, needed help to find replacement parts for his machine. Some iron lungs were found stored away as forgotten relics. "I've found them in barns, I've found them in garages, I've found them in junk shops," he said in a 2017 interview. "Not much, but enough to scrounge for parts." And in some sports headlines, Iowa women's basketball coach Lisa Bluter is a semifinalist for the Werner Ladder Naismith Coach of the Year Award. Bluter also was a semifinalist a season ago and was the recipient of the award in 2019. The Naismith Coach of the Year Award is presented annually to the most outstanding men's and women's head coach who achieves tremendous on-court success. Fans will have a say in the determining the winner. Starting March 26th, fans can visit naismithfanvote.com or on Twitter at MarchMadness-WBB and at Naismith Trophy to cast their ballot for one of the four finalists. Voting ends at 4 p.m. April 2nd. Iowa senior guard Caitlin Clark was named a semifinalist for the 2024 Naismith Player of the Year Award on Thursday. She won the award last season and was a finalist her sophomore year. Fans can vote starting March 26th at naismithfanvote.com or on Twitter at MarchMadnessWBB and at Naismith Trophy. The Charlotte Sports Foundation and Ally Financial Incorporated announced Thursday the lineup for the 2024 Ally Tip-Off. This year's event is scheduled for November 10th at the Spectrum Center in Charlotte and will be a doubleheader, featuring a rematch between number 2 Iowa and number 13 Virginia Tech, and a battle between number 1 South Carolina and number 11 North Carolina State. "We are excited to once again play in the Ally Tip-Off," Iowa coach Lisa Bluter said in a news release. "The tip-off was one of the most exciting events of the early season for us Hawkeyes to compete in." Iowa men's basketball assistant coach Sherman Dillard was named to the a step up Assistant Coaches Hall of Fame class of 2024 on Wednesday. The 2024 class also includes Tempe Brown from Stanford, Andrew Calder, North Carolina, Stephanie Norman, Oklahoma, Curtis Townsend, Kansas, and Jason Williford from Virginia. Iowa State sophomore Taman Lipsey was named a semifinalist for the 2024 Naismith Defensive Player of the Year. Of the 11 players named as semifinalist, three of them are from the Big 12. Lipsey is the only underclassman to be named a semifinalist. And in indoor football, bringing a football championship to Cedar Rapids is the goal for the new River Kings franchise in its first season as a member of American Indoor Football League. Dominique Montero, the team owner, and his staff have worked hard to create a team filled with talent while creating many partnerships with the Cedar Rapids community to reach that goal. Montero says, "There's never been a championship team in Cedar Rapids. I've always viewed Cedar Rapids as a football town, and I want to bring a championship to this community." This is not the first taste of indoor football in Cedar Rapids. From 2012 to 2020, Cedar Rapids had a team in the Indoor Football League. Ownership changed and the name went from the Titans to River Kings in 2018. After the COVID-19 pandemic, Cedar Rapids was not included as a league member in 2021. Montero now has brought indoor football back to Cedar Rapids, keeping the River Kings name and joining the American Football League. The league will have 7 active teams this year, and the plan is to expand to 10 teams for 2025. The River Kings will be coached by Darren Clark, who owns a wealth of football knowledge, Montero said. Clark has an impressive resume that includes a stint in the NFL, along with winning multiple championships in the Canadian Football League as a player. The River Kings roster was finalized Monday and cut down to 25 players. Their training camp took place in the CRSA facility in Hiawatha. Clark sought after and did much of the recruiting to help build the roster. Several notable players on the roster are Ricky Neal Jr. and Terrell Carey, who both played college football at the University of Northern Iowa. In 2017, Neal Jr. earned All Missouri Valley Football Conference second team honors, highlighted by leading the conference in sacks with 9.5. In Carey's one season with the Panthers, he caught 7 passes for 95 yards and finished his collegiate career at the University of Wisconsin-Oshkosh. Other notable collegiate players on the roster include Enoch Smith, Jr., Michigan State and Oklahoma State, Verlin Reed, Jr., Ohio State, and Devontae Butler, Ohio State. Indoor football is unique and different compared to the usual outdoor version. It is played on a 50-yard field with 10-yard end zones. 8 players are on the field for each team at once. 3 linemen, and 5 skill players. The team is stacked and loaded, Montero said. Montero describes the game as predominantly a passing game, and that a good team will score 60 to 70 points a game. Scoring occurs at a much higher rate in indoor football, creating the opportunity for games to be quite entertaining and exciting to watch. The River Kings kick off their season this Saturday against the Missouri Falcons at home. Kickoff is set for 7 p.m. Home games will be played at the Alliant Energy Powerhouse. Tickets can be found on the team's website, Ticketmaster, and on the CR Events Live website. Montero is hoping to enhance the game day atmosphere for fans, which include prizes, halftime entertainment, and autograph sessions with the players. Saturday kicks off the beginning of a 10-game season for the River Kings. And in some news from outer space, the SpaceX came close to completing an hour-long test flight of its mega rocket on its third try Thursday, but the spacecraft was lost as it descended back to Earth. The company said it lost contact with Starship as it neared its goal, a splashdown in the Indian Ocean. Until then, most everything had gone well following liftoff from the southern tip of Texas near the Mexican border. The ship has been lost, so no splashdown today, said SpaceX's Dan Hewitt. But again, it's incredible to see how much further we got this time around. Two test flights last year both ended in explosions minutes after liftoff. By surviving for close to 50 minutes this time, Thursday's effort was considered a win by not only SpaceX's Elon Musk, but NASA as well. As Starship soared higher and farther than ever before, the space agency is counting on Starship to land its astronauts on the moon in another few years. The nearly 400-foot Starship, the biggest and most powerful rocket ever built, headed out over the Gulf of Mexico after liftoff on Thursday morning, flying east. A few minutes later, the booster separated seamlessly from the spaceship and plummeted into the Gulf, although not exactly as planned because of what appeared to be an entry engine issue. The spacecraft continued toward the east with no people or satellites on board. Starship reached an altitude of 145 miles as it coasted across the Atlantic and South Africa before approaching the Indian Ocean. But 49 minutes into the flight, with 15 minutes remaining, all contact was lost and the spacecraft presumably broke apart. If you're looking for something to do for the rest of the day, the Oscar Mayer Wienermobile will be at the Oakland Road Hy-Vee from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. today, Edgewood Road Hy-Vee from 2 to 5 p.m. today, and in the St. Patrick's Day Parade on Sunday. And former Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin said Thursday that he will put together an investor group to buy TikTok after the House passed a bill that would ban the popular video app in the U.S. if its China-based owner does not sell its stake. During an interview at CNBC's Squawk Box, Mnuchin, who served under President Donald Trump, said he had spoken to a bunch of people about creating an investor group that would purchase the popular social media company. He offered no details about who may be in the group or on TikTok's possible valuation. This should be owned by U.S. businesses, Mnuchin said. There's no way that the Chinese would ever let a U.S. company own something like this in China. TikTok did not respond to a request for comment. The House bill, passed 352-65, now goes to the Senate, where its prospects are unclear. Lawmakers in the Senate have indicated that the measure will undergo a thorough review. If it passes, President Joe Biden has said he will sign it. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, March 15th, 2024. I'm your reader, Grace Barter. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is EarthDate. A decade ago, there were typically 20 earthquakes a year that were large enough to feel in the central and eastern U.S. But in 2015, there were over 1,000 of them. Why? It's mostly because we're pumping more water into the ground. The boom in U.S. oil and gas production over the last decade has brought many more oil wells, which also produce water. Most is naturally occurring in the formation, and some was injected by operators to allow or improve the recovery of oil and gas. In both cases, the water will likely have picked up salt and other minerals from the rock, making it many times saltier than seawater. Operators may re-inject this water to continue to liberate oil and gas. But more often, there's too much to handle, so it's trucked or piped to disposal wells, where it's pumped down into deep saltwater reservoirs. Adding large volumes of wastewater increases the pressure in these rock formations, which can allow natural faults to slip more easily than they normally would, causing earthquakes. To address these quakes, regulators and the petroleum industry are monitoring disposal wells and shutting down those that could cause damaging seismic activity. And they now think that managing wastewater injection more carefully should help. There's still more work to be done, and university research centers, like the Bureau of Economic Geology, are conducting major studies with the aim of minimizing the risk of earthquakes while maintaining the benefits of domestic energy production. For EarthDate, I'm Scott Tinker.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.